It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 588 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week is another great doubleheader episode featuring interviews with William Simpson and Lewis Southard. William Simpson is an internationally renowned artist known for his work on Judge Dredd, Batman, Transformers, Vamps, and Indiana Jones. He recently released VMT from Renegade Arts Entertainment, which is described as a tale of blood, monsters, and those that walk amongst them seeking to help us all. We discuss his career in the comics industry, what VMT actually stands for, and what else he's working on that is not to be missed. Then everything wraps up with the return of Lewis Southard, who is bringing fans a prequel to his Midnight Western Theater series subtitled Witch Trial. It's described this way. Before the woman in black, there was only Hortensia Thomas, a young girl in a wild west filled with threats both supernatural and all too human. With a new cast of characters and her black-clad destiny looming over her, you'll witness Hortensia like you've never seen her before. Lewis updates us on all he's working on, and that you need to let your local comic shop know you want this series before the final cutoff date of Thursday, May 18. A quick word of warning, this book comes out from Scout Comics, who I help behind the scenes. I'm sure you're going to enjoy what they both have to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. The man who knows that vampires kill their own lunch, sure don't sparkle, and are rarely troubled by teenage angst has created a new vampire comic series that spills the blood on vampires in our world today. The bloody brainchild of William Simpson, VMT represents his unfiltered vision for a real vampire story. A new vampire graphic novel series that he's both writing and drawing. And I get to talk with William Simpson today. How you doing, William?
I'm doing very well, Wayne.
It's good to talk with you.
Yeah, this is going to be highly entertaining because I love it when somebody else describes something that you've done and you're sitting there thinking, is it?
That's great. that's publicity is not everybody's strong point. And so... Sometimes when people write about it, you're never quite sure. Is that really what the book is about? Okay, well, all right. That's good stuff. Now, first thing I got to ask, what does VMT stand for?
Well, it can be a whole bunch of things, but basically it's all about bloodletting. So I guess, you know, vampire menstrual tension is probably where it came from. And it's just... When I started to actually think about this, I mean, Alex and I were sitting firing things at each other, and it sounded simple and straightforward without any concerns about anything other than the fact that it was all about blood, and the fact that the characters, my three main characters, are three female vampires. I guess I went for the bloodiest thing that I knew about.
Ah, okay.
From my relationship, but the point is, it's you know, the bloodletting thing is just it's an absolute must for vampires. It's not kind of, you know, they normally don't avoid it, so it's something that happens constantly, and you know, that's kind of what it's like, isn't it?
Yeah, because I gotta ask you, of course, as somebody who has observed vampires going on for decades and decades, and I always think, okay, this is going to be the end of the vampire trend. And that never happens. What is it about vampires that you think appeals to people and continues to appeal to people, even after decades of storytelling?
Oh my God, since I just know with me, since I first read Bram Stoker's Dracula, I was a kid. I was like about 12 years old, 10 years old, 12 years old, lying in my sick bed at home. And my mom had gotten me Dracula out of the library. So it's one of those old books. It really, you know, it was an old edition. It was, and yet it still is one of the great freaky stories of all time. I mean, Bram Stoker, another Irish guy, that's good, wrote this tale. And you know, it's carried on ever since. I mean, nobody has stopped creating Dracula stories. You end up with a, you know, he starts off as a some kind of terrifying thing because he's like a big leech. He's a blood-sucking beast. And then you find all the sympathies towards him. And I mean, throughout the ages, people have always found a slightly different viewpoint on Dracula. And, you know, then, of course, one gets into realizing that the vampire character, the idea of a vampire, has been around for a long, long time. And it's not just about Vlad Dracul turning into the vampire. There's been vampire stories like Varney the Vampire way back in the kind of early days of the 20th century. God, you know, it seems so weird talking about centuries that, you know, that we've moved into a different one. Because, you know, as you're growing through something, all you think about is well, it could never end. Anyway, the thing is halfway between stuff. Varney the Vampire is one of the first comic or pulp kind of illustrated characters, you know, in a newspaper, as far as I remember. And this is only going by the history of comics that one reads about. And then there was a character called Spring-Heeled Jack, I think, which was also something that was kind of vampiric as well. These vampires, you know, there's myth stories, there's ancient stories in different cultures. I was over in Herceg-Novi in Montenegro last week, and I'd heard this before, but somebody was telling me that the first vampires were out of, you know, Croatia and places like that. And they've got stories about some weird, wonderful character from there. So you're talking about something that, you know, goes far back into time, and we have just kept wanting to see more stuff about them. I mean, one of the things that certainly I never wanted to do with it was to make it just a super friendly vampire story, so that you had, you know, like we did the T-shirt that vampires don't sparkle. Mm-hmm. I mean, because much as that was a great kind of franchise for young teenagers, I guess, I just couldn't get into it at all. The idea, you know, vampires going to school and it's all nice and easy going and stuff. And they fight werewolves and it's always the same. The point about the vampires that I always was interested in was that they were things that you had to stop. They were things that they didn't let go of what they were after. They were going to drink your blood. You were in trouble whenever the vampires were in existence. I mean, it's kind of why I love The Lost Boys and I love Near Dark. You know, to me, two movies that came out at a similar sort of time period, within a couple of years anyway, I think. And they were, you know, The Lost Boys was still a youth movie. But it was fantastic. I mean, the idea of these guys still hanging around in a cave in California, you know, still out there eating their way through society, and Near Dark being something that was brutal. I mean, it's probably one of the better vampire movies that I'd ever seen. Near Dark was fantastic. Do you remember it?
I do. I remember it. That the thing about vampires, I think, that mystifies people so much is that they kill you, but you get pleasure out of it.
Yeah, and then you also often come back as one, which again is like, then you get to go on and do all that. But you see, that's the other thing that of course, has come out with vampires. People are so into the fetishness of being a vampire. I mean, the fact that there are clubs where people are convinced that they are vampires and are wandering around doing their thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a strange area to allow your brain to be in, I would imagine, you know. I mean, everything then comes down to sex and you know, fantasy. And I guess, you know, that's probably a driving force within human beings anyway, is sex and fantasy.
Right. I'm kind of curious because your book goes a very different direction. You know, talking about Dracula, and almost all the vampires I've ever seen were males. So this time you're doing three younger females, which I have to be, I have to say, is something I've never seen before. And I have to say that I'm big on female lead characters. I've read males forever and ever and ever, and I know what they're going to do. But you put a female in there, and I am mystified. I don't know what's going to happen.
They're much more interesting. There are reasons for doing things. You know, there has to be a real reason for them to do stuff. Whereas a lot of the male characters, it's just, yep, I want to drink blood, I'm going to do it. I absolutely agree with you. But something you missed out on then, Wayne, was that way back, Elaine Lee and I had done vamps for DC Comics, which were five Viking girl vampires that roamed around America sucking blood. And the thing was, we had three series of vamps. And I mean, I loved doing that. I mean, Elaine had written such great female vampire characters. I mean, there was a wealth of personality in there, and she was, you know, running a gamut of different types of people, and it was really good stuff. Something that also Hollywood had wanted to make movies of it. So we're actually quite surprised that never happened via DC. It's something they've just let drop.
Well, to me, it's the vast majority though tend to be males. So to me, the female, yeah, and I'm not as familiar with your previous stuff as I should be, but I can
fill you in on that.
Okay, well, talk about that, because does that help you understand the VMT a little bit better, or is that like required reading to read before you read VMT?
No, nothing that I've done before is required reading, I wouldn't imagine, because I've certainly not got into the writing side of things before. And this has been basically, having worked with Elaine for so long doing vamps, and then when it wasn't happening anymore, and I was doing a lot more film and TV work, the thing was, I got into writing animation scripts first with my brother for a little company that we had, Rogue Rocket. And we were trying to develop a bunch of our own stuff. Stuff happened, and then it shut down, and we went our ways. And I continued into film. And a lot of the scripting that I was writing were film projects, which again, I'm still pushing away at. But one of the wonderful things about doing a comic book, you can actually get it done. I mean, films happen, but they sometimes take a long time before they actually happen. And there's a lot of money involved in making a film. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've grown up with films all my life, and films influencing a lot of the work that I would have done. But the point was that with this, it was like, well, I'm sitting down to write a script, and I knew it was a comic book script. It wasn't a film script, because if I was doing this as a film script, it would be very different, I think. And the point is, I really wanted to continue doing vampire stuff. I hadn't finished whenever Elaine and I had stopped. It was still something that I wanted to explore. And Elaine was off doing, she was doing animation work as well, and game stuff, and other cinematic stuff. And so, you know, it's like you... When you start off doing something and you're doing it for yourself, there's no money involved. So the point is that when you start off doing it for yourself, you're kind of allowing yourself to just indulge in what you're interested in. And I would agree with you that the female characters, as I was saying earlier, I've always been more interested as well in that side of storytelling. I mean, a lot of the movies, there was that whole thing that was put about whenever I was probably in my 20s, where... you know, they said about how all young males want to go to the cinema to watch Arnold Schwarzenegger and Van Damme and, oh, my God. stuff that was all, you know, action related films, as opposed to having any interest in anything else. But for me, I mean, you knew who the male characters were and you knew what their performances were going to be. I was more interested in seeing, well, what do the female sidekicks do? What is their purpose? You know, it's like for me, I think I said to you at one point that, you know, in that awful, it is an awful film, Commando. I mean, it's hilarious, but I mean, Ray Don Chong is more interesting to me than what Arnold's doing. You know what Arnold's going to do. But she was the fun thing in it, and she was like the person where all the, you know, she was having all the adversarial stuff fired at her because, I mean, she's just a woman off a plane. It's, oh my God. It was so, and it's the same thing. I mean, when I think of, you know, my favorite science fiction, Ripley in Alien is, you know, the one of the biggest characters in a science fiction series ever, and was the most interesting character as well in Alien, and has continued on. I mean, I find it fascinating that she managed to maintain, you know, her character throughout all of the films. You know, the four original ones. And it's the same thing with in The Fifth Element. Mia Jovovich was fantastic. It was like I was so interested in what she was doing and what she was going to be doing. And you know, if you go through, God, there's so many great films, great science fiction films. Anyway, that our female leads are the only reason why the male character can do anything. I mean, there's the intelligence, the sense, you know, the hold on a minute purpose of the female characters. And it was the same in Aliens. Vasquez was fantastic. She was more interesting than any of the guys that were kicking about there. So you had Ripley and then you had Vasquez. Anyway, so many strong female characters. And I mean, I was just really interested. I wanted my characters to have lives that had certain purposes, which of course are not all revealed in the first book. There's a whole bunch of stuff that I want to delve into to do with time periods and to deal with the reasons why they are the characters that they are. There's probably a little bit more on Mercy in this first book, because just because of her point of view of eating religious people. Again, it probably says more about me than it does about anything else, and my feelings about the restrictions of the religious, you know, right side of the population. You know, I'm not anti-spirit. I just find the construct of religion tends to be something that causes us all to keep fighting. So, and coming from Ireland, it's always been one of the issues that happened over here. And you saw it all, and you always sat back and thought, "What the hell is going on here?" And it's so the point is that she has a preference, and she tries to try. I mean, she tries to stay away from eating anybody that it's, you know, from her point of view is unnecessary. So she goes after religious characters of all sorts, all religions. So
now, but why don't we talk a little bit about, because on the cover you've got three female characters. Yeah. Do you want to talk about who they are, general, so people get some idea who they are?
Well, we've got Sun, who is, I just like the idea of a vampire being called Sun, considering they're meant to stay out of the sunlight. I liked it. And she's the Asian vampire, and she's the youngest vampire. So her identity has to be explored as well, because we haven't stated why or how she became what she is. Mercy is from a certain period of history. And again, her vampirism is all connected up with religion. And then the other figure on the cover, which it is misleading because she's got six arms on the cover. She doesn't have six arms in reality. It's like a statue. She is she's basically beyond time, you know, out of time. She's been around for so long that her, even her type of vampirism is a different thing, and she's pre and after Scheherazade, who whispered to the caliph and was the Thousand and One Nights character, and but her history comes from before that, and that's something again I really want to explore later as I go through it. So she tends to be in a completely different headset to the others. Mm-hmm. There you go. That's my theory. I'm not going to say it all, Wayne, because the problem is I don't want to tell anybody what the story's all about, other than it's three vampires that are very different. And yeah, and hopefully there's enough blood to keep satisfying people.
They don't interact with each other, do they?
Well, this is the point, that any good team of girls will eventually come together at some point. Mm-hmm. And within the story, they do finally end up in the same space, and you know the it's as the second story continues, there would be much more, I think, of an integrated nature starting to happen, but the first story allows you to bring them in from three different directions, you know, and actually. You as the reader discovers them as they discover each other. So,
mm-hmm. Now I have to say it starts out really interestingly. I have to say one of the vampires is standing on the hood of what looks like a Mustang.
And, it's a BMW.
That's what it is. That's right. She says that right when she talks. She curses.
There's a reason for that. Yeah.
She curses and she yells out about that, and she's got a pipe or a long piece of pipe or something, and she's banging on the BMW with all she's got, and she says words that young readers shouldn't probably ever read, but she goes on and have all kinds of fun. I mean, she goes on this car for two pages basically, yeah. And then somebody comes out and says, "What are you doing to my car?" And I love that her reaction says, "What am I doing to your car? Your car? Actually, I thought it was somebody else's car." She goes, which I right off the bat, you've got this really interesting mix of humor and horror together. And I found that really fascinating.
Well, I'm really glad, Wayne. Thank you so much. That's very nice of you to say. I just followed my nose really with it, because the point was those couple of pages, her beating the hell out of the BMW, which came about because I'd had an interaction with a guy in a BMW, and I realized that over the years, a lot of the worst drivers that I'd actually seen on the roads were driving BMWs.
So this is kind of wish fulfillment for you.
And they all seem to be executives somewhere. So I just like the idea that she was so bad tempered and pissed off that she would take it out on somebody's BMW. I mean, I drive a Japanese car. I really like my Japanese car, and I don't do crazy things in it, you know. So I just thought, yeah, beat up a BMW, nice start. But
let me ask something about real quick though. One of the things when she finally gets to being a vampire and she bites somebody, she does something I've never seen a vampire do before. She identifies the type of blood. I've never seen any other vampire do that before. She starts to bite, and all of a sudden she yells out, "B negative." And I was like, what? She knows what the flavor of the blood is. Wow, I've never seen that before. So is that new? Have you done that before in your books, or is that something new that you're doing in this issue?
It was the logical thing for her to actually say and identify. I have never tasted blood quite this way that I would be able to identify it, even my own. But the thing is, I mean, come on, they've got to be able to do something interesting. And the idea that you're sensitive to the different types of blood, it'll lead its way to other things, I'm sure, later on. The thing is that you set up things, and you know you set them up because they're an idea, and then you don't know at all what that's going to lead to. I mean, storytelling is something that does happen. It just kind of fleshes itself out as you go along, and you realize you've already set up something that means something later on. And I hope that there will be some kind of interplay there. I know with Mercy, there's that kind of understanding of what is in the blood, and her reasoning and so on is very, very different. Sun is just something. She likes this. She thinks vampirism is cool. She's actually enjoying being this thing, whereas Mercy isn't.
Yeah, it's good to have the characters that have different characteristics. Oh, they
do, different outlooks.
Yeah, of course, conflict then comes as a result of that, and then we get to see, you know, their different takes on various stuff, and there's some really odd stuff that goes on. And of course, I don't want to spoil stuff, but there's people getting tied up, there's people getting all kinds of wild and woolly stuff. So if you think you know what's coming, I can guarantee you, you don't when you read this book.
You know something? It's like, All of the stuff that I threw at it, I have to say this, that to me, it's, there's a lot of stuff in here that I don't like, in the sense of it's the things that would make me feel horrible. It's the things that, you know, I look at the world as we're in it and I'm horrified by. So a lot of what I start to touch on are things that I would personally find repellent. And I was thinking, you know, the whole thing about a horror book is it's meant to be horrible. It's meant to have, no, but seriously, it's not like, you know, super nice vampires and super nice situations. I like them. I really like the three characters. But the thing is that, you know, they are primarily, you know, blood suckers or energy suckers or whatever of humans. Humans are the cattle for vampires, I guess. And the thing, I don't know, I guess you would remember the brilliant series, The Tomb of Dracula, that Gene Colan did.
Yeah,
right. I say Gene because there's a whole set of different writers, but the point was that he drew such a massive amount of story. The man was incredible. And the thing is, I've got all, you know, his volumes here, and it's one of those things that how they kept the dark and menacing, you know, character through that whole series of books. I mean, this is a lot of great stuff, and of course, very traditional, you know, vampire hunter characters as well. I mean, the fact that the Van Helsing lineage, you know, drifts through all that is fantastic. And now, of course, we've got movies of Blade, and we've got movies that are TV series about Van Helsings, and you know, the thing is, that part of vampire lore, which came, I mean, that's come from Bram Stoker as well. I mean, it's absolutely wonderful. To me, that's what you're wanting to touch on. But, you know, you have to try and find new things to do. And the point is, it's about character. If your characters are going to be interesting, they have to have their reasons for doing things, but you don't reveal everything at once. You allow it to play itself out, and you try not to be hitting everybody with a big hammer to tell them what it is that's happening. Right. So anyway, I hope it doesn't hit everybody with a big hammer. I hope they can, you know, work their way into the story, you know, not just assume they know everything at the beginning, you know? I mean, that's one of the terrible things when you're watching a movie and you kind of have roughly guessed what might be the ending, and then it turns out that you were correct.
Oh, now, I hate that. Well,
you see, and I don't want it to be like that. I want stuff to have. I mean, some people will, but the point is, you want it to lead people along where they're not certain what's going to happen. But of course, if they flick through to the last pages, they'll know what's happening.
Of course.
I hate that as well. I can't stand people who read books by reading the last pages first.
I used to work with a lady who used to read the end before she would read the novel, because she wanted to make sure it ended up in a good place where she liked it.
It's like my mother. That's hilarious. My mom watches so many movies that she's watched before because she knows how they work out at the end.
Yeah, I can't understand that. I can't waste my 2 hours if I know where we're going already.
Yeah, know, unless it's a bloody good movie, right?
Yeah, well, unless it's terrific and I want to see how did they do that, then I can see it again. But I cannot stand that. I just that of course, I hate people that spoil stuff too. We have a friend
who
loves nothing better than spoiling. Well, I saw that. I saw that, and you'll like it when this happened. And we're kind of like, no, don't do that to us. Don't do that to us.
I have to say that that happened to me on Game of Thrones, because I did 10 years working on Game of Thrones. And the thing was, there was a certain point in one of the seasons. It's a season where, you know, Jon Snow has a terrible period of time. And I remember because the American transmission was always so many hours ahead of the British transmission. Now, I knew what was going to happen because obviously I was working on it. But the thing was, when you were watching it, you like to divorce yourself from all of the knowledge that you had about what was coming. Mm-hmm. And this young character, as it turned out, posted a message that was before the people in Britain would have had the chance to see the particular episode.
Oh,
right. And because it was out in America. So he posted certain character RIP, and he got so much flack because people who knew about it flacked him. People who didn't know about it obviously flacked him lots. Mm-hmm. And one guy saying to him on Facebook, it was like, "You are not welcome in Japan ever." The whole continent, our country, was like, "No." And the worst thing, it turned out to be a nephew of mine. I couldn't believe it. I had to write to him and say, "This is not cool."
right. Well, let's talk a little more about the book, because I'm really fascinated by it, because it's 170 pages is what I see is that in it. Yeah, it's a pretty good read. Of course, I love a long read. I'd like to sit down and fall into the world and be in there for a while. And of course, U.S. dollars, it's anywhere from $9.99, I guess, for the soft cover. Maybe that's a digital download. The digital download
it must be a digital download, because I think it's about $18 or something.
Yeah, $19.99 is what it says.
Oh,
on
is that
here.
What it is? Yeah.
So what it is. Now I want to make sure people know how to be able to get it, because there are a lot of good vampire people out there. It's at Renegade Arts Entertainment, and that's all one thing, .com. And you can go under products, /products/VMT/. And you go in there and you get all kinds of good information about it. And you can order it there. And they'll mail it to you. Now, of course, it'll cost you something, because Renegade Arts is in Canada. But they'll be fine as far as that goes. So, there's 170 pages, and you've been talking like you've got more stories to tell with VMT. Are you working on
that? I'm already halfway through the second series. You know, because the point was, I was doing this stuff in between a lot of the movie work that I was doing. And the thing was, I would come home at night and maybe draw a couple of panels, because I've been working all day, and then at other time periods I would, you know, suddenly get a 2 week lunge at it and be able to do a couple of extra pages. Mm-hmm. And then I would later on I would find myself going back and changing things and so on, because there was that luxury with it because of the fact that I was doing it in between everything else that I was doing. And the thing is, it took its time to get done, which is probably why it is 170 pages. I mean, that's nuts. But I designed it to be, you know, six issues of individual comic.
Right.
I mean, I thought we were going to do, you know, a nice little run of here's the six issues. People can get used to it. Then it'll be collected as a book. And then there'll be the next thing and so on. Well, the point was, Alex made he made good sense in putting out the book. And I think these days, you know, individual comics, it's a tough one to get them pushed out there into any kind of market, I suppose. And the fact that they're, if it's not from, you know, like the big couple of companies, it's much harder for people to even bother concerning themselves with something like this. My background, I had done lots of DC work, and I'd done lots of 2000 AD work in England. I even worked on British Marvel's Transformers years ago. And the thing is, I mean, it's kind of roughly where my beginnings were. And, you know, I have a huge history of working through comics and working on some really cool characters. My Hellblazer run that I did for DC Comics, luckily the very first storyline that I got to work on was Dangerous Habits with Garth. And it was, you know, it's the one that's went on to be the Keanu Reeves movie and so on. Mm-hmm. So the point is my fingers and pies have been in very strange places. It's like the Aliens story that I did with Ian Edgington was the one where the Alien King was introduced. The Alien King was never introduced in any of the films. The Alien King was not in all the other books. We got to play around with this character that was the Alien King. And of course, afterwards, I don't think he's appeared since, because 20th Century Fox went through the roof over the fact that we developed something that was not part of their thing. So the point is, I've ended up working on some very strange kind of characters. And enjoying it all, because I never thought, you know, I'm just doing the comic. I wasn't thinking what its future would be. You know, it's really nice that the Hellblazer stuff seems to have such a reaction all over the place. I think a lot of that's obviously to do with Garth. But the nice thing is that people still obviously come along looking for Constantines. And when Aliens is just Aliens, I'm just so glad that I was part of that huge thing that is Alien. It was nice to do that tale, and it's been reprinted a whole bunch of times. But the thing is that it's not like somebody that's new to comics that just stepped in here to do a comic book. You know, to me, it's still that first love that I have I always wanted to do comics, and when I started doing comics, it was that thing where, you know, I was so happy with getting to work on anything. But the fact was that I was lucky to get to work on a bunch of, you know, different major kind of creations. I got to do Batman as well and Legends of the Dark Knight. So, you know, there's a lot of me out there in bits. It's not like I did, like Gene Colan, I did 9 million years on Dracula, you know. It's just like there's always been things that I felt lucky to get to do. And there's more stuff coming up. But yes, as I said, I actually went straight into the second book and found myself, copious notes of what, you know, I wanted to delve into within the second story. So I'm quite happy to get on with that and see where I end up. And I'm hoping to do a third book as well.
Wow. Okay. Well, the first book came out just in time for Halloween.
Yes, that's right. You're right. It did. Because, yes. Yeah. Good timing then.
That's brilliant. Because, you know, I always like to refer to Grant Morrison's Klaus comic. It started the week of Christmas and then it went through the book of month of May. And I was probably the only guy in the month of May still buying a Christmas comic. And so I always say, please do these things before the holiday, because once the holiday's over, everybody moves on to the next one. So but that was brilliant.
Well, when would you, or when should you do a horror book? It has to be a Halloween. I mean, I know Alex was going to bring it out earlier, but then he decided to hold it.
Yeah.
And he held off until, and I thought it was great. You know, it was a smart move. I did a signing round about Halloween. That's right.
Yeah. Now, what about the second? Are you going to do the second volume? Is that going to come out in time for this year's Halloween?
That is a massive question. I would doubt it because I am, as I said, I was getting on really well. Then I got a film job. Then I got another film job. Then I got a few other things that I had to finish off. And so it's sitting throbbing in the corner waiting to get attacked for some more. But it's funny. I was going through my pages last night, just looking through to go, yeah, that's okay. That's okay. That's okay. That'll do. That's good. So I do an awful lot of going over stuff and thinking, oh, it should be better. It should be better. Anyway, the thing is, but you see, once it's been set up to be what it is, I think, you know, you have more chance of allowing yourself a little bit of leeway when the other books come out. But I would love to get something out by Halloween. It'd be fantastic if there was a way of doing it, because I just think it's what it should be. I mean, you want to see horror movies at Halloween. I hate the fact that we've lost our seasons, you know. It's mm-hmm. I mean, there's Christmas movies on at the moment on television. I mean, the channels just keep those things going. And they're not even the good Christmas movies. But the point is the same thing is the same thing with horror stuff. You know, you want it to be late night Saturdays. You want it to be or late night Fridays as well. Yeah, and you want it to be something that's just not ordinary. You know, it's not just shown all the time. You want it to, you want to have specific time periods for it. Good God, back when we only had four television channels in Britain, it was like, you know, there used to be a thing with late night, Saturday night horror movies, old black and white Bela Lugosi and Lon Chaney and Boris Karloff movies and Hammer films, loads and loads of the Christopher Lee stuff. And it was just, it was great because you kind of got yourself prepared for that. You wanted to get, you know, an injection of the horror stuff at least at some point in your week or month, but it had to be very specific. I mean, oh my God, Halloween hardly passes now before there's actually the Christmas stuff in the shops before you get the chance to get through Halloween. And in my youth, Halloween used to be always one of those times that, everything was dark, everything was spooky, and you invented spookiness in your head. It's a bit like Charlie Brown and the Great Pumpkin, whatever the hell that was. And it's that whole thing where there's a time period where these things should be seen. There's a time period where, you know, we should really be indulging in them. And you know, Cary Grant and the Bishop's Wife, give me that at Christmas. That'll be fine. Mm-hmm. I don't want to see it the rest of the year. I want it at Christmas.
So if people want to keep up with your stuff, are you on social media at all?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram, and I'm on Twitter. I haven't thrown myself into the world of TikTok, but the point is, I am out there, and I mean, mostly I use social media just to put up artwork or photographs, that, you know, of places that I'm at conventions or doing stuff, because it's like, for me, the artwork's the interesting part, you know. It's like and the images that you take, it's all, to me, it's all part of the art persona that you know, that's kind of my life. So the thing is that you know, as stuff comes out, if I know it's going to be printed you know, relatively soon, you don't, you know, put it up, you wait until it comes out in print, like my Rogue Trooper picture that came out this week in 2000 AD. So it's nice to actually, you know, make a thing about the bits of work that you do. I'm working on a horror horror thriller short film that I'm hoping that I get to direct this year, and there's a feature film version that I'm working on that I hope, if we get the short done, we get to maybe get on with making the feature happen. Thing is, with all of that stuff, as I said earlier, the film takes a long time and tends to be, you know, kind of pie in the sky for so much of your existence, because, you know, is it going to happen? Is it not going to happen? Is it going to happen? Is it not? The nice thing, as I say, about doing a book, you know, you can hopefully get a publisher who wants to do it based on the fact that they like the artwork or something like that. And thus, if the story works with it as well, then it's a double plus, because I was always somebody, of course, growing up being, you know, getting into art. It was always, you know, my collection of comics are all artists. It's kind of like, if you know what I mean, it's like my favorite artists, that's the characters that you went out to collect. It wasn't so easy for me to get into getting a run of a particular writer if the artwork wasn't great. But there's stories I love to this day. You know, there's a lot of Alan Moore stuff that I really, really like. And but going back to Don McGregor's Kilraven, absolutely stunning piece of work that I kind of read every you know, every couple of years, I'll sit down and just go through the whole bloody thing because it's great. It's great comics. And Doug Monch is Master of Kung Fu, you know, the Paul Gillespie stuff. Beautiful work. I mean, this is stuff that can, you know, it just drags you into it. Mind you, during COVID, I spent a lot of time reading Savage Sword of Conan's. He went through so many of the Savage Swords because, again, it was like there was just something about it that once you started on it, you just wanted to get more of the story. So I go through periods.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, it's all kind of great stuff. And again, it's VMT. And if you want to get it, you go to Renegade Arts Entertainment, all one word, .com, and go /product/VMT. And you can order it there. Maybe your local shop can do it too. I don't know. But
I know that a lot of the comic shops have taken small batches of it. Certainly Forbidden Planet over in Britain did it, in Ireland. I think, again, I suppose if people will ask for it, there's a good chance that the comic shop will get it in. Thus, they're not necessarily paying the huge transport.
Right, which would be great. So, well, it's a great book. And William, I'm looking forward to these other things. We'll have to keep our ears to the ground and make sure we catch up with all the stuff that you're doing, because it's lots of fun. It's like I said, that book, I had no idea from page to page what was going to happen. And I like that when I read.
I hope that's good, Wayne. I hope that's good.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
It's great to welcome back to the podcast Lewis Southard, creator of a really fascinating book called Midnight Western Theater. It comes out from Scout Comics. And how you doing, Lewis?
Oh, I'm good, Wayne. It's great to be back. It's been quite some time since I've been on the show, so it's good to make my imminent return for all the faithful listeners.
Well, you've been busy, so that's a good thing. You're busy making comics, and that sometimes that's more important than getting on and talking to people. But you got to balance the two, it seems, these days. You got to, if you're a comic creator, you got to also talk with people about the product. So got to do it every once in a while.
Well, I'm a one-man PR team at this point, but this is the fun bit. This is how you know the comic's actually done and ready to come out eventually, when I start to pop back into the public eye.
Okay, well, that's good. Good to hear. Because now, one thing I got to mention is that I do help out with Scout Comics behind the scenes, so I got to do that. So there's no conflict of interest here. I have zero to do with your book, which is why it's a good book, probably. And it's a great fun book to do.
Not a conspiracy, ladies and gentlemen. We're not some secret cabal trying to peddle this book onto you. This is the first time we've spoken in 10 years, it feels like.
Yeah, well, not that long, but it may feel that way, but it's fine. So why don't we start out with talking about the first Midnight Western Theater, which I enjoyed, by the way. I thought it was really great.
Oh, thank you.
Talk to me about what was the basic story in Midnight Western Theater, the first volume.
Well, I think it's right to say that the first book is completely different in every way from this upcoming book, Midnight Western Theater Witch Trial. But the original, just your vanilla Midnight Western Theater, was an anthology book. Each issue was a different adventure featuring our protagonist, the woman in black, who is an undead adventurer. And her in the first volume, her sidekick and companion, Alexander Wortham, the reluctant vampire. So it's basically just the first one's just a Weird West romp. Let's put it at that.
Mm-hmm. How many issues were in it?
Five issues.
Okay, because I enjoyed it. Cause, I like female lead characters because they're unpredictable to me. Male leads, I have a feeling I know what's coming a mile away. But the moment you put a female lead character in, I'm going like, now what? Now what? I have no idea what they're going to do. So I like that about it. I like the fact that you had a female. What's interesting, too, was back in that era, mid-1800s or late-1800s, we always have this weird idea that men were the complete dominant thing and women only sat there and had babies and ran the house and stuff like that. But there were a lot of female characters who were characters, you know, who were interesting people and that stuff. And I think it's our perception and the way we look at it through like novels and things like that is the guy, it was a guy thing, but it really wasn't.
Listen, Wayne, I did little to no research about the Wild West, really. But when I was making this, I know there's Annie Oakley, Calamity Jane, but I only know the names, and then that's it. I just wanted to have a female protagonist because I think every Western film I've ever seen is usually a male protagonist. So I was like, okay, I'll just make it a lady that make it a little different. So yeah,
shake it up, make it something different, which is, that was one of the things I really liked. Like I said, I don't know what a female lead is going to do. And so for me, that's really kind of fun. And although I have to say, I've read several Western comics now, and I think yours was the first, but I've read others that have had female leads. And to me, I always find those fascinating. So I'm big on that. I think that yours was the first one I read about. And then I really fell in love with that whole idea. So really good stuff.
Well, what's fun with this is the first one, she is our protagonist. But funnily enough, you don't learn that much about her backstory, which kind of leads into this next one. Because you kind of have an idea of who she is, but you're not. She never turns to the camera and says, "Here's my life story." If you read every issue, there is an overarching flashback story that sort of serves as an introductory tale of how she ended up in the world of, let's say, the supernatural. But there is a good window of time that's left to unexplored. You don't really know, I guess, the true origin of Hortensia, the woman in black. So that was kind of the inception, that just piqued my interest as a creator, because I think this is safe. After the first book, Scout came to me and was like, okay, that was good. You can make another if you want. And I was like, damn, I hadn't really thought about that. And I sat down for a couple days and I'm like, okay, well, what do I do? And I always had it in my head to maybe continue the formula of, okay, make another batch of one and done adventures with some underlying or overarching plot. But I figured, well, you know, there's this big gap of time that's not really explored, before the first volume, and I said to myself, well, there's something there. And I think because I didn't know, or I didn't think it through, you know, some people, they have a plan, or they know they thought everything out when they're making something. But for me, I didn't. And then that just piqued my interest. I had to come up with the answers as I went along.
Great. Well, a couple of good things in there. Number one, when a comic company comes back to you and says, you can do more if you want, that's a good sign. You know, that doesn't always happen, let's just say. So that's a good thing. And I also like the fact that, you're doing things, you're once again doing things a little different. You shook it up with the female lead. Now you're changing the pattern in the second batch of Midnight Western Theaters. and changing that somewhat. You gave me a chance to read the first two issues, which I really enjoyed. I have to say, I did note, you said right out of the gate the thing I was going to tell you. This is a very different comic from the last one, and I like that. I like when I don't know what's coming at me, and I have to read it and pay attention. So this book is just as good, I think, as the first one, but in different ways, and I like that.
No, thank you. Well, I guess that's the whole point. You know, when you have another shot at something, you know, like you said, it's a big opportunity when a publisher is like, okay, you can keep going. And I think the sequel problem is, okay, let's replay the greatest hits. But with this one, I really wanted to just do something different. The first volume is Welcome to the World. I'm like, this is an idea. Let's use the phrase high concept, but like, this is a concept. Like, okay, now let's try to spin it or tell a different tale in a different way. It's familiar, but it's also unexpected, as you put it. And this is not me talking out of school, but there are moments in this new in the sequel, which is a prequel, that you would never expect in a million years, especially after reading the first one. There are some like scenes that that you no one can predict. And that makes me happy, and I think readers will enjoy seeing that. I think it'll be a ride, and I hope people won't get off the ride. So I think I want them to stay buckled in to the end and go through all the peaks and valleys ahead of them.
Okay, now one of the changes, the second group has a subtitle called Witch Trial, which we didn't have in the first one. There really wasn't a subtitle on the original one. But Witch Trial, and you said this is a prequel. You mentioned that we didn't get into the one character's backstory, and I didn't want to make an assumption about that, and maybe we shouldn't know at this point. Is this the backstory that the one character didn't get in the first series?
Well, okay. This is not a spoiler. This is the plot, but Midnight Western Theater Witch Trial is Hortensia's origin story, and the way it is going to be framed is that it's a coming of age story. It's taking if you read the first one, the woman in black is a very stoic, very distant character, but also very determined, confident. You know, if she knows she has to do something, she's going to do it no matter what. And in this new one, you see her as a teenage girl, and she's got some of those bits, but she's a little insecure. She's a bit unsure. She's not going to pull the trigger every time. There's a bit of hesitation there. And you have to look at that being like, okay, how do you get from point A to point B? And I know with the prequel problem, is people will be like, well, I know how it's going to go, or like, there's no real stakes with the book. But, you know, we know Hortensia will live. But the best part about this is there's a whole new cast of characters with this book from her earlier years. And that kind of creates the drama and intrigue with this one. I think any good prequel has to be... The interest has to lie in how it happens, and I think this book pulls off with that execution. I think it'll get people interested in how she ended up like this ruthless, cold-blooded killer in the future.
Mm-hmm. On the cover of the very first issue, you've got a subtitle thing. It calls her the Born Again Girl. Which I find, of course, once you turn into the very first page, I don't know if I want to spoil it. Something happens. I guess that's how she gets the title.
It's not a spoiler because it's in the first. This isn't really a spoiler at all. In the first volume, you see her origin story of how she enters the world of the supernatural, and it's a bunch of cultists sacrifice her on an altar when she's like 8 years old, around there. And then between issue 4 and 5, you see her die. And in issue 5, you see her wake up. And all the cultists are dead. Something has clearly happened, but she doesn't know. All she knows is that she died, and now she's been resurrected. This issue 1 of Witch Trial immediately opens up with filling in that gap of time of what happened in between the ritual. And it explains why she is referred to as the born again girl. So that sort of sets its path. But you mentioned the subtitle Witch Trial, and this is also not a spoiler because she is introduced in issue 5 of the original book, but that leans heavily into Hortensia's basically foster mom, who is a Sarah Bishop, the Wild West Witch. And she is the new partner, sidekick for this specific set of issues.
Mm-hmm. So instead of a younger guy, we've got an older woman.
Oh yeah. Well, we went from let's say lovers in the first, or like casual lovers in the first one, to mother-daughter dynamic in this one. So already, even the dynamic has changed completely.
Mm-hmm. Well, right off the bat, you did something that I always thought should happen. Somebody does a ritual. Of course, who are they trying to get? They're trying to call up, and of course, it's Satan. And of course, and the assumption is made that they call up this demon, I guess, suppose, and they assume it's Satan. And the first thing he goes, he says, "Satan." And they said, "I'm not Satan." And I love that because I have always sat there. Satan's got to be a busy guy with all these people calling him up, and you know, making him do things and stuff like that. So I was very satisfied to see that it wasn't Satan that they called up. There was another guy, and I enjoyed his name. I got a kick out of it. He's called the Fireman.
Oh yeah, no,
which I loved.
I love him. He's one of my favorite new additions to this world, and he definitely adds on to the lore. But he pops. He will pop up again. I'll say that. But he is one of my favorite new characters to write.
Well, I love the fact that instead of getting Satan, they got somebody else. And then they're kind of puzzled. And the one guy goes, "I'm confused. Is he the Satan fella or not?" And that made me laugh out loud because, and even the demon has to say, "Oh, you stupid mortals." So I love that whole business. I thought that sequence was a wonderful sequence to see because so many times I've read these books and Satan is always popping up the moment they call. I'm going, I want to see somebody else for a change.
Well, I'll be honest. That whole moment is a little, it's inspired by Neil Gaiman's The Sandman, because I always got a kick out of it because it's in the first issue where they try to summon death, but they accidentally summon Dream. And I always thought that was so funny of just accidentally, you do summon a god, but you summon the wrong god.
Yeah.
And I always think that's funny. So I was like, okay, that's a fun concept.
I like it because so many times, you know, it's so predictable. And this one, I literally, they're confused. And the great part was, I was like, oh, good. Okay. And then, of course, we jump to 9 years later. And things are very different.
Hold up, Wayne. I gotta preface this. Let's not spoil too much. We can't reveal. Okay. We can't reveal every nook and cranny. We gotta entice people. We gotta take them out to dinner. We can't just jump straight into it.
Okay. So, what should we know about the book that you'd like us to know?
Okay. Good question. I think so. For this book, it, like I said, it's a good. Oh, if you read the first one, this is a perfect companion piece. As many people have told me who have read it, if you read the whole thing, you kind of look back on the first one and it makes you see it in a different light and makes you see Hortensia in a different light. But it's also, I would say, very new reader friendly. I think if you just want to get in on this one, you very much can. Because it's, like I said, it's a whole new dynamic. It's kind of a whole new world. And it's pretty straightforward. It's not really trying to confuse you. So if you just want to get in on it, then you can. And I guess a Cliff Notes version of the plot without giving away too much is Hortensia's foster mom, who is a witch, long ago made a deal with a demon for her soul. And she thought at some point in her life that she had killed the demon. And now it's been revealed that the demon has survived and he is hunting Hortensia. And there's a bit of a ticking clock because Sarah, the mother, is trying to find him while protecting Hortensia at the same time, while also withholding the information that Hortensia is in danger. So it's this is very much, I guess, a ticking clock kind of book. There is a looming threat. But luckily, there's also this great new character, I love him, named Governor Jamie Corson. And I think if you were missing Alexander, Alexander Wortham from the first book, he's a wonderful substitute. I think if we had a woman in black in the original one, luckily we have the man in white in this one. You always need a white hat, good guy cowboy to come in and set things right. I think it's nice to see a traditional hero. It'll be fun to explore a traditional hero in this book. So he's a wonderful new member of the cast as well.
Yeah, he's very different. I don't want to spoil anything. So now I'm nervous about spoiling stuff. So what can you tell us about that character that we should know?
Okay. I think it's a cruel world, Wayne. I don't have to tell you that. And in this book, Hortensia is very, very lonely. And like, she's only known her mother, really, and her mother's associates within this weird West world. So I think Corson presents himself as, I guess, Hortensia's first ever friend that she's made on her own. And I guess it's kind of her learning to be more independent, to make her own decisions. And, you know, I guess like any teenage girl starting to rebel more against her parents, you know. So she's just hanging around this guy, and you know, he's not doing too bad. He's the governor of the valley, for Pete's sake, and he seems to be on the up and up. So
that seems word is the important word, I think, in there. Well, we'll see what happens as the story goes along. But there's a character in there, and I don't want to spoil too much, but I don't know what it is about bird masks that gets people about like that. And there's the character to which the mother is talking is the guy, a person wearing the bird mask. And I see that. And the moment I see that, I go, oh man, don't trust that person.
Go ahead.
No, I'm just like, who is that person? And what's the deal with that person? Why did they have to wear this bird mask, which I think is hot as Hades to wear? And there they are wearing it, and somehow they still can talk through it and stuff like that. Why is that character like that? I'm just sort of curious.
Okay, well, that's the Plague Doctor. Who funnily enough popped up also in volume one as another adventure named Altaholne, who was a native. There was one issue of the original book, which is about a Native American adventurer named Altaholne, who bumps into the Plague Doctor in the middle of the desert. And if you are a Lou lore lover, like many people are, then you will know that the Plague Doctor is a character that popped up in another one of my books. And he popped up as like a mystical type character. So when I was making the original one, I was like, oh, I'll throw him back in as a bit of an Easter egg. And then with this one, I kind of opened him up as a full-fledged character. I'm like, okay, let's go into his backstory. He's part of the world. He's got connections to the protagonist. And I... he's dressed, he's a plague doctor, and he's in the middle of the 1800s, which for your history buffs out there is inaccurate. And I kind of, I never say it, it's kind of implied, but there's one issue that goes into his backstory. Let's say he's a lot older than he appears. And let's just say the bird mask motif has been his thing for a very long time. And when the plague doctor costume rolled around in, let's say, 1500s, 1600s, he's like, "Oh, I like this. I'm sticking with this. This is my outfit."
Okay, because I can't imagine how you breathe in that thing. I don't know. But anyway, I guess that's me being trying to figure out things. But I'm always fascinated when I see that. And the moment I see it, I go, "Don't trust that person." Anybody who wears that.
It's not about practicality. It's about style. It's about fashion. You know, some people have worn a lot worse, but have made a big statement. And I think this guy makes a statement when he pops up in the room.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. He makes a very big statement when he shows up. So it's great stuff. I really like it. Now let's talk a little bit about the change. It looks like you've got a different art team.
Oh yeah.
Talk about that. I mean, David Hahn did the first one, and this is Butch. Is it Mappa?
Yes.
So was that part of the change that you wanted to make when you went to do the second series, was to get a different art team on it, to maybe get a different feel?
Well, the quick answer is no. like David is the co-creator mm-hmm. of the whole series. Mm-hmm. So I reached out to him to be like, "Okay, we're gonna get the ball rolling on the sequel. Are you available to do it?" And he said, "You know, unfortunately, he couldn't do it because he was busy with another Scout book, another great book, Impossible Jones, by him mm-hmm. and legendary comics creator Carl Kessel. Mm-hmm. So he could not do it. So I went, I put out the call looking for someone to fill in, and I met Butch. And Butch is one hell of a guy. He's a great artist, and he works so hard to make this the sequel. And it was such a joy to have him come on and step in David's shoes. But I feel like if you're a fan of the original, Butch really tried hard to kind of encapsulate the vibes of David's art while also making it his own. You know, it's not very jarring. If you've gone from the first one to the second one, it'll feel very tonally consistent. But it's also still Butch's distinct own style, which I think is what any artist would want. But we also have an up-and-coming colorist, Sean Peacock, who he did a fun bit of research for this book. He looked over a lot of old vintage romance comics to kind of get a color palette for this specific miniseries. And then I have my ever faithful letterer returning, Buddy Bodwin, who's worked on everything I've ever made. Got him back. He did a great job as per usual. And then we got cover artist Julianne Griep to do the some beautiful, I love them. I think they're the best bits of the whole book. But these beautiful Art Nouveau covers for each issue. Mm-hmm. And speaking of wanting to do something different, like the first volume, black and white covers, you know, very simple images. And then mm-hmm. with this one, it's like we're going full color, we're going full fancy. You know, if you put both books on the shelf, it would be like a night and day comparison, which I think is very fun, you know, when you're dealing with the same series where it's like, you'd be like, "Holy shit, that's from the same series? Doesn't feel like it." So I think visually it's very distinct. No, I couldn't have been happier with the creative team I assembled for this one. It was a perfect group of people, and I'm very thankful for all their hard work on this one.
One thing that stood out to me was the color, was that there's a lot more color, a lot brighter colors being used more of the time than there was in the first one. The first one was kind of dark. I mean, the woman in black, of course, wore black. the sidekick wore black and other things like that. So this time there's a lot more color, especially even on the wardrobe of what they're wearing. So it gives it a totally different feel.
I think it's fair to call the first one sepia toned, and then this one is, well, you know, it's like I said, trying to do something different, and it's fun to see the same world just in a different lens. And I think if you want to go into like a metatextual sense, you know, it's set in the past. Maybe the past feels a bit brighter sometimes. And then when we deal with the present, it's very almost dour looking. So,
mm-hmm. Well, of course, then too, they're darker characters at that point too. You know, it's called the Woman in Black for pity's sake, and that's a darker thing. She doesn't get called that yet in the books that I got to look at. But it's really interesting to me to see her relationship to the mother is really, really different, which I really like, because, you know, you're right, she's getting to be a teenager and she's getting rebellious, which is nothing new for teenagers, but the way that she handles it is kind of she's showing some of the attributes that we'll see a lot more of later on, which I like, that we get to see her be a stronger woman and kind of take charge and kind of say, no, I'm doing what I want, kind of stuff, which I really like, because that was probably not something women in that era were expected to do. So it was nice to see her kind of stand out and be her own woman.
Oh yeah, no, I think you see, using the example from the book, she is starting to become more assertive, but that doesn't necessarily mean she's right. Like anyone who's ever been a teenager, you could believe 100% in what you're doing doesn't mean it's not stupid. sometimes our parents are right. And this is kind of an example of that. But I think, you know, using Sarah, talking about her, this is, like we've said, a mother-daughter kind of adventure in relationship. And it's kind of neat to see Sarah. I can say this. She's not a perfect mother, and I don't think she knows 100% of what she's trying to do or how to do it with raising Hortensia. And I think it's kind of neat to see that flawed kind of person trying very hard to protect their child, but they don't really know the right way to go about it, especially when it's dealing with, I guess, generational trauma, if I'm using that correctly. Like, she's mm-hmm. like, Sarah has her own issues that are now being reflected in the present with Hortensia, and that clouds her judgment or makes her more reserved with what she's getting at than being more open and to the point, which, you know, can lead to disastrous results.
Well, Sarah is still a human being, and I don't know any teenager who thought that their parents were wise and sage and did the right thing all the time. It's rare to see that. And to see her struggle with her assertive, as the word you used, a daughter, is she's not quite sure what to do about that. And when she finds out that there's danger around the corner, her motherly instincts kick in, and boy, things really, really start to move forward in a pretty strong way. And I really like that about her. I felt sorry for her on some levels, because here she is trying to protect her daughter, and the daughter is saying, like, get away from me. You know, I don't want you to protect me. I'm a grown woman now. Don't do that. And I felt sorry for her on many levels, because she's trying. She knows the dangers better than her daughter does, but daughter won't have any of it. I like that.
I think it's very real, which mm-hmm. is kind of what I'm getting at with these kind of books. You know, it's you know, it's a supernatural Weird West, like bang, bang, pew, pew. I think that was more of the first one where it's like, okay, we got a problem. There's a werewolf and we got to shoot the werewolf. And, if, you know, we're going to bicker a bit, you know, like, oh, Alexander, you're a coward. It's like, oh, well, you're an idiot, Hortensia. And that's like, oh, but in the end, we saved the day. And yeah, there's some dramatic tension. There's some problems. And I think it's fair to describe the first one as more of, I don't want to use the word simple, but it's more to the point. It's more straightforward. What you see is kind of what you get. And this one, it kind of goes a bit more into the characters, and it's more character driven. There are fantastical and supernatural and horrific and very scary things that happen in this one. But it's all rooted in some very relatable problems, some very relatable dynamics, and just issues a lot of people can face, whether you're a parent or whether you're a young person trying to figure out your way. And it's also a book, I think, which it's a book about trust. And sometimes we could put our trust in the wrong people. I think that's a good way of putting that. We could put our trust in the wrong people. It's a cautionary tale. Not everyone has the best intentions for us, and the people that do, we should really appreciate that while we may not agree with them 100% of the time, they care about us and have our best interests at heart. So that's what I think is at the heart of this.
Well, I have to say, and I'm not going to spoil it, but the second issue has my favorite Sarah moment in it. Let's just say that she is going to defend her daughter, and she's going to use any means necessary. And when she does, I was impressed. Let me just say that she's a very strong character, and she shows it particularly in the second issue.
I love Sarah. Out of any of the characters I created for this one, she was the most fun to write. She is the most interesting, and I think if I ever got the chance to write more, I just love the focus on her more. But if you loved her moment in issue two, and everyone listening, she's got an even bigger moment in issue three. She's got something huge going on there. So
oh boy.
Keep an eye out for that one.
Oh boy, I got to see that, because I thought issue two was going to be her glory moment. You know, when she let's just say when she grabs the bull by the horns, shall we say? And I really loved that. And not that she escapes unscathed, shall we say? But let's just say that there's just so many interesting things going on with her. She really is a good character. I do have to say, the fact that she wasn't in the original series makes me worry about her. But I really like her. I think that as far as mothers go, you could do worse.
Thank you. I appreciate that. No, I think she's a welcome addition to the universe. And yeah, her fate's kind of up in the air. You know, you got to read the series to find out, you know, what happens to her. But you know, I guess what should I don't know. It's not really no one's going to predict what happens. I'll just say that no one can predict it.
See, I like that. I like to be surprised, and it's rare when I get surprised in comics anymore. So I'm really looking forward to being surprised. I think that's going to be great. Again, it's Midnight Western Theater. Let's make sure we get it right. And it's called Witch Hunt. It's the second group. I would recommend you get the first group. I don't think you're right. It's not necessary, but I think you get a little more out of it if you read the first series, if you can. And so it's really wonderful stuff. Be sure you get to your store this week, because the final cutoff is, I think it's the 19th of the month. So 18th. Don't wait till 18th. Don't wait until the 18th to let your store know. Go and do it right away and tell them you want Midnight Western Theater.
Witch trial
from Scout Comics.
Well, let me say this. You know, these books live and die on the pre-orders. So you know, if you like the first one, I would say go in. This, of course, I'm biased, but go to your local comic shops or specialty stores. You can ask them to pre-order the first one. But if you want to be my best friend in the whole wide world, ask them to pre-order all five issues. You know, it's low commitment. They'll be there for you, and then you'll be good.
You know, you got to do that. It was just sad to say, because my store, if I don't tell them I want every issue, they'll just order number one. And I'll be like, when number two comes out, where's number two? Well, you didn't say you want number two. I said, well, I said I wanted the series. And so be thorough. Tell your comic shop you want them all, because not every comic shop understands that you want them all. So be sure to do that, which is great stuff. So I'm really looking forward to how this is going to work out. This is going to be a great fun. To see how this all turns out. Some good stuff. Now, Lewis, I would be remiss if I didn't get an update on your other books. How are the other things that you're working on? What's going on with them?
Well, I hopefully by the time that this is released, this has been announced, but it's not really a secret. I am currently working with Sumerian Comics on a 3-issue noir series that will be coming out starting this September. Called The Blackout Bombshell, which is a completely different from anything I've written before, and I'm very happy about that. I'm working on this with amazing artist Dean Kotz, and I've got just a hell of a grouping of individuals working on this. Like, when it is fully announced, you won't believe some of the names, some of the people who are working on this specific book. But just brief elevator pitch. It's set in the 1960s. It is about an alcoholic detective named Jack Atlas who, during an alcohol-induced blackout, he is hired to solve a case. And by the time he is sobered up, he doesn't remember who hired him. He doesn't know what he's supposed to do. All he knows is that he's somehow landed himself in a world of trouble, and he's got to work his way back. So that's my big one coming out later this year.
Oh, wow. And you said Sumerian Comics.
Yes.
Okay. So, of course, that leads to the next thing. If we want to keep up with your stuff, and by the way, I want to mention, too, I always expect the unexpected from your writing. Whenever I've read your stuff, I never know what's coming. And I, as a long-term reader, that's one of my favorite things, is to be surprised. And you always do that for me. And, boy, I really, as a reader, appreciate that. I wanted to get that in there.
Well, thank you, Wayne.
As far as keeping up with your stuff and being able to know what's coming, on social media, how do we do that?
Well, I'm on Instagram at Lewis Southard, and I'm on Twitter at Lewis J. Southard. Those are the best ways to find out what I'm up to. So, or you can just Google me. My website's there. I'm there. I exist.
Okay. Mine's just spelled Southard just for people, just so they know, because the internet is unforgiving when it comes to spelling errors.
Well, my name, I'll give you my whole name. We'll make this a whole spelling bee right now. Okay, so Lewis, this Lewis is Louis, and my last name is Southard, which is Southard. So I'm Lewis Southard. So you can find me everywhere.
That'll be good, because there's all kinds of good. And if you want to read something fun, something you haven't read before, pick up one of his books. Get his books, because I have always been surprised and always fascinated by the writing that you do and the way that you're able to make things happen that I just don't see coming. I believe me, I love that. I read comics many times and say, oh, okay, here's where the hero is. Oh, yep, there it comes. Okay, so I saw that coming. I can't do that with your writing, and boy, I love that. I think that is... I wish more writers were like that, because that is something really important for people to do.
No, oh, thank you. Yeah, well, it's my cross to bear, being ever so talented. but, you know, someone has to do it. Heavy is the head that wears the crown.
That's right. That's right. Now, and again, well, Scout Comics would get mad at me if I didn't mention it. If for some stupid reason you don't get to the store in time and get to that, you can always go to scoutcomics.com and buy books through there. But that's your last resort. Be sure to get to the, we want to go through the stores first because that's the important thing. So be sure to do that. And Lewis, I can't wait to read. I've already got two issues in and I'm hooked. So I hope other people will get out there and make sure their stores order it for them because this is going to be a fun read. I just can't wait.
Do it now, everyone. You have to. You have to. I'm begging you.
Okay.
And that's it for this week. Be back next time. We'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.
What's that?
I'm on the tumbler? Oh, you wouldn't be interested in that.
This baby works just fine.
So what do you think?
Does it come in black?